you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst with your hosts, Mickey Desai and Susan Cooper. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
Welcome to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. I'm Chuck Shelton, the CEO of Great Art Consulting. I have the honor of hosting a short series of conversations around the impact inclusive leaders can have. Let's start a great-hearted conversation. Today on the show, we're excited to have Meeta Malik, a corporate changemaker with a track record of transforming businesses. She has led branding work with iconic products like Aveeno, Avon Color Cosmetics, Chapstick, and Dove. She is currently the head of inclusion, equity, and impact at Carta and is a top LinkedIn voice of 2020. With DC Marshall, she co-hosts the Brown Table Talk podcast, where they share stories and offer practical advice on how women of color can go beyond just surviving and start thriving in their organizations. Meeta and I have had the chance to do some great work together, and today we're going to talk about transforming the ways we lead inclusively. Hi, Meeta. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's an honor to have you here today. So let's jump into the first question. Going back, early in your career, what did you notice that motivated you to become the change agent for diversity, equity, and inclusion that you are today?
Where do I start? I noticed a lot of things. I think one of my first memories of doing an internship in corporate America, I won't name the company, is that I kept getting mistaken for the executive assistant. And that's not a bad thing, except I was the only person of color interning. So none of the other interns were mistaken for the executive assistants. I want to make that distinction because interns do a lot of things like get coffee and make copies. But people kept coming up to me as if I was the executive assistant. And they didn't treat the other interns that way. So that was one of my first really strong memories of that, where you just get that pit in your stomach. Huh, no one else is getting asked to do these things and no one else is getting mistaken for being the executive assistant. So that really stays with me. And then I think as I just grew in my career, really small things, which I know we'll talk about, and that's why I started Brown Table Talk, the podcast. Experiences like I don't get to present my own work, but others do, my peers did, conversations about, you know, stay in your lane. You know, my friend Lan Fan, who's the founder of Community of Seven, just posted about this on LinkedIn, about how you are sometimes forced to shrink to places to fit in a way that you don't want to. And so this idea of like, hey, I'm just here problem solving, but all of a sudden it's like, no, stay in your lane. Why are you taking on that assignment? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? So I think there were just a lot of things over the course of my career early on that I observed very quickly that made me feel like I didn't belong, right? I didn't feel comfortable being here or working here.
I'm struck by that only one dynamic of noticing that you're being treated differently in objectively experienced ways. And then your language like shrinking and fitting and staying, like there are expectations and roles that you kept bumping into that other people may not have been, and its impact on you.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes the advice that you're given just doesn't work. And what's the big advice is like, take a seat at the table, right?
Always. Yeah, right.
I remember another meeting where I got in, I remember that day at 5:30 in the morning, right? It was a big presentation to the exec team. I'm going to be on at 8 a.m., set up the whole room, the deck, everything. And I got a seat at the table. There was a lot of seats at that table. Yeah. And my manager walked in and said, you need to go sit in the back over there. Because we want to make sure that everyone else gets a seat. And I'm like, well, who's everyone else? And so there's an example of I'm actually taking a seat at the table and I'm being told to go sit in the back. And it was really interesting. Later that afternoon, I saw the president of the division and he said to me, that was a really great presentation. Why didn't you take a seat at the table? And I was like, well, if you only knew. And yeah. I just smiled and said, thanks for that advice. I'll do that next time, because I wasn't going to talk about the dynamic
right.
of that manager.
Right. Yep. So it's like literally a seat at the table.
Yes, literally. I did
yeah,
that.
I mean, this is not just a metaphorical seat yes. at the table. We're talking about.
Happens. Yeah. And you know, Chuck, what happens after that is then you don't want to do it again.
Right.
That's the shrinking even, you're talking about.
So even if the president encourages you to, if you haven't navigated it with your manager, you're still caught.
Yes. And to your point, I tried the first time. Maybe I tried a second time. And if every time I'm being told right. to go in the back, I'm not going to do it again. And that is what you're talking about, the shrinking.
Yeah. Yeah. I when I think of actual seats at tables, I so contrast that with the privilege that accrues to me as a white man. And the older I've gotten, when we used to actually be in rooms with people as compared to doing everything virtually, one of the things that I do as an executive consultant is get to a room early and try and figure out what seat is the power seat, and I sit in it.
Wow.
Because it's one of my goals is to make sure that the room understands that I see myself as a peer to whoever else is in the room, even if it's the CEO. And that, you know, I try and do that as early in the process as I can, because it's a way to send a signal that we are in service and we're coming from that place, but we're not going to suffer from too much deference. And so, what a different contrast for maybe you and me walking into the same room, making judgments about where we sit down. Of course, that's related to where we are in our careers too, but still it's striking.
Well, Chuck, I think now you and I would fight for that power seat, right?
Yeah. But, yeah. So, we wouldn't, because if you went and sat in, I would say, you so belong in that seat.
Well, you would sit next to her. I would sit next to you.
I just want to sit next to Mita. That's all. I mean, I would, that kind of deference I would love.
But you know, I think you bring up a really interesting point about also what allies like yourself and you, I want to say very publicly and boldly, have showed up for me as an ally in many ways. So I thank you for that over my career. And there is a piece that we don't talk enough about often, which I want to educate allies on, is through the cultural lens. I'm the proud daughter of Indian immigrant parents. I grew up mm-hmm. bicultural, and I was raised for 18 years in an environment which was really about children are to be seen, not to be heard. Everyone's an auntie or an uncle, which might mm-hmm. freak some non-Indians out. So
right, I would not do well.
Chalk, for my kids. And then you're not supposed to question authority. And it's almost like you are supposed to be invisible and in the background, and your work will speak for yourself. So in those early years of that situation, I wouldn't want to sit at the table. It's okay if I sit in the back, because right. my work will speak for itself. And it doesn't. We know that's not the case.
So how do you, and this kind of connects to that same first question around navigating, you know, over the arc of your career. It sounds to me like going from the context you grew up in to the context of what's going on in your mind as you go into a conversation with an internal partner or a customer or into a meeting about where you sit and how your voice and agency will be felt and heard. That sounds like quite a journey in terms of your internal conversation.
It is constant. And so people see me showing up very differently today in my life. But that struggle is always there internally.
Yeah.
I've trained myself. And trick now, Chuck, is I never want to disappoint people. I think that's true of many of us. And so now I think about, if I have been hired to do a job, and if I show up to a meeting and don't speak up, I am disappointing those people who have put me in the room. And so that is the flip that has now occurred for me, that I owe it to myself, the company, others, whoever's counting on me, to use my voice. So that is the difference now of how I approach the situation.
Yeah, that's really helpful to hear you say it that way, because my experience of you is that you are very consistently present. You know, you're like, it looks like you have your intentions well in hand, because you're attentive, you're on purpose, and you're in service. I've always felt your openness to ideas and to like what's going on in the moment. And it's such a tale of what it means to get to know one another and to be allies to each other. Cause I need your support in the way I work as well, to know that kind of something about the wheels that are churning behind all that intentionality and effectiveness.
Yeah, and you're right. It's probably because of my fear of using my voice or the lack of confidence I've had over the years that now I show up with such intention. I have to. But I also owe it to the people who are giving me their time, right?
Yeah, yeah. I like
that.
Yeah. I like that kind of owing obligation language, because it's about showing up because we are in service and we're expected to do it. Therefore, we get to expect ourselves to do it.
Yes. And that has been absolutely.
I like it. So you and I have had the chance to equip people in a lot of different roles to think bigger and transform the way they lead through inclusion. One of the ways we define inclusion is the dramatic growth in character and performance. What are the biggest DEI challenges that companies are facing right now that deeply call out for transformational change?
I think the biggest challenge, which no one really talks about, is that this work starts at home. Hmm. And so I don't know what the recent stat is. We've spent billions of dollars on DE&I training. Chuck, I know we've worked at Unilever together. I'm excited that we're working together at Carta, the great work we're doing. And that work's important. And yet I can put you through an amazing workshop or a series of classes. And at the end of the day, you are going to go home to your communities. And the question I ask leaders is, how do you spend your weekends? Who are your neighbors? Where do you grocery shop? Who cuts your hair pre-pandemic, post-pandemic? We're still in the pandemic. And when you have a major life decision, who are the five people you call who are not your family? And if they all look like you, act like you, and think like you, I think the real conversation we're not having is we're self-segregating. And so that's not something you can really teach people at work. I mean, you can, but we spend so much time, and now I'm doing the podcast from my bedroom, right? So the last 17 months, but that's what's really that we're not talking about. You know, a white leader can come to me, as I've coached many, to say, Black Lives Matter, Mita, what's the journey to be an ally? How do I show up? How does the company show up? How does the brand show up? And the question you have to ask yourself is, do you have any meaningful relationships with Black people in your life? Which is the really uncomfortable thing no one wants to talk about, but it is about building those cross-cultural bridges. Yep. And so that to me is what's missing in all of this. I don't know how to help people if you're not doing the work that starts at your kitchen tables.
I think it's so right on to center a question and a conversation about transformation in relationship. Because we can go to curriculum, we can go to programs, we can go to ERGs, we can go to the political and social context, we can go to history. There's so much we can go to, and it's all good stuff. It's all context that matters. If I look at what's kept me in this work all these years, there's like relationships, and then there's everything else is hardly in view. Because the way that I put it, and I see it happening with other people, is that I have other people's voices in me. You know, when somebody says something and it's just people who look like me in the room, since you can't all see the podcast, I'm presented as a white guy and I identify that way. I have choices to make about how the voices in me are saying, and they're pretty loud right now after this many years, people saying, so what are you going to say, Chuck? What are you going to do? What are your choices? You know, do you stand by and then solve it afterwards? You know, what do you do? That relationship piece, we're doing some work with a client right now that's kind of the key part of the struggle with people from multiple advantage backgrounds is that they really when they ask what's next, they want to know what the curriculum is, what the tool is, what the learning resource is, what the study is, what the book is, what the, you know, web link is. And we're just acting awfully countercultural and saying, so the answer to what's next is your choices and decisions about building relationships of trust and accountability. You have all this awareness, and the next stage for the work has to be centered in, are you building relationships? How are you growing relationships with people who are different and similar to you, and explicitly in the context of trust and accountability? In other words, are they saying to you, you know, when you did this, this is the impact it had on me. Thank you. Keep doing that. Or when this happened and you didn't say anything, I really need you to speak up or whatever. It's about the conversation, it's about talking about things we don't talk about.
Absolutely.
Like you just said. And to me, that's like one of the new great indicators of good DEI work is people saying, okay, we've never talked about this before. It's scary. but I'm really proud that we're in a company that we can talk about this.
Absolutely. I can recall several years ago having a conversation with a leader who was in Vermont at the time. And when I approached him about this sort of line of questioning when I coach leaders, and the response was, well, what do you expect me to do? Move? Right. Because Vermont is, as you know,
Vermont
color. Yeah. And so that is, I think, sometimes, and we all can be defensive as human beings. I certainly can. That could be the defensive move. And now the last 17 months have shown us you can make wonderful relationships everywhere and anywhere. A big shout out to LinkedIn, which is where I, if I'm in social media, it's where I'm spending my time. I've met so many incredible people. It's such a platform of generosity, as my friend Callie Schweitzer says. You can meet people. So it doesn't mean you have to meet people in your neighborhood, in your community, if your community does have to be self-segregated, right? And so just to be intentional, whether it's through ERGs, whether it's through individuals at work, suppliers, vendors, there are so many ways in which you can meet people who have different experiences than yours. So I don't buy that as an excuse.
So if you're listening to this podcast, I hope you hear what I'm hearing from Mita right now. And that is that the nexus, the place to go to invest in transformation is in yourself, in relationships of trust and accountability, because then the systemic and cultural issues that we must engage are engaging, whether it's around talent, recruitment, retention, advancement, whether it's the connection to the customer, all of that in our organizations will flow out of our relationships. And it can't work, at least in my experience, any other way. That's where transformation, you know, needs to come from.
Absolutely. And when you build these relationships authentically, they're not tokenistic. For the relationships in my life that matter to me, I don't think about any of those friends, let's say my white friends. I don't think they come to me to be like, oh, Mita's my token brown friend. I don't think that at all, because our relationships are deeper.
Because it's Mita.
Well, and it's also how you would build any relationship, right?
Right, exactly.
So don't think about it that way. If it is kind of a check the box exercise, when I just pick up the phone to call Mita because I have a DE&I issue, or I want to think find a brown woman to get an opinion from, then you know. But if it's you're really trying to authentically get to know each other and help each other, it's just going to serve everyone in that relationship in so many ways.
That happened recently in our interaction when I identified you as someone who has a sense of humor and willingness to laugh is so much a part of my view of you. And then you shared that apparently your family didn't think you were that funny. So I thought that was funny.
Yeah, they think they're funnier than me, but I'm going to tell
you. I felt a little sad for you. So I would like you to make sure that they know how funny you truly are.
Thank you.
Other people think you're quite funny.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I'm going to tell my husband and my brother. Yes.
Back to the personal, you know, and professional interface, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, there's the big questions around transformation that we touched on by focusing on relationship. On the opportunistic, encouraging side, what do you see that's working for inclusive leaders? What brings you hope in the work when there's so much that can discourage us right now?
I think since the diversity tipping point of last year, which I didn't coin by diverse and engaged, there is much more of a willingness to learn and listen and to be curious. I find, especially from white colleagues that I haven't seen before. Now that's just my opinion. Listen, you know, I also do this work because I'm a half glass full person. So progress is slow, but I believe in it. So I'm keeping at it like many of us. But that's what I'm seeing. There's a lot of diversity washing if we think in the macro marketplace from companies as well. We know that. And I also think there's been companies like Sephora, like Target, we can mention many in the marketplace who are making progress every day, and who in Sephora's case made some mistakes early on, but wow, like you look at what they're doing. And you know, a company just doesn't show up that way. It's the people that make up the company. So going back to like inclusive culture, it goes back to N01. I always say it goes back to how do I show up every day? And when I show up in a negative way, that sends a ripple effect through my team and the company. And so if we each can really, with intention, think about how we're showing up, that's when you see the real positive movement and change happen. But that's what I'm excited about. Yeah, I just think people are curious and asking me questions that they wouldn't have asked before.
And how are you, or how often are you at risk for tiring as the diversity answering person and the, you know, the interpreter of all things diversity? I mean, it's your job, so there's it's built in, but I certainly, we all been hearing about the weariness that can go with it, as lovely as it may be in terms of a new level of interest that seems authentic. How is that landing for you?
It's been tough. It's been a tough last 17, 18 months. Yeah. I've been open to say I lost family members in India to the pandemic.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I have a 6 and 9 year old. I mean, I've been the summer camp counselor. I failed at that. I've been the virtual teacher, the laundress, the chef, the referee, plus trying to make impact at work. So it compounds. The way in which I like to create boundaries for myself, and I will joke with people, you don't need to ask me what anti-racism means. Ask Google. So there are some basic things that you can do research on.
Nice.
So I encourage people, if people will come with a question, I'll send them a link back. If I often get asked this question, can you help me with DE&I work at my company? I cannot. I have a wonderful full-time job, but I have Chuck, you on a list of 10 people that I'll shoot over to. Right. So those are ways in which I've sort of just tried to protect. Yes, it's my time, but more my mental health.
Right.
And the emotional burden it can take. But I've also chosen to do this work, and it's a privilege to do it. That's how I look at it.
That's so good. I feel like coming out of when we do return to work, whatever that looks like, back into the office, for those of us who've had the honor and privilege of not being able, of not having to go into the office, since so many have and gone to work. It feels to me like we're probably going to have a 2 or 3 year period where the people from advantaged backgrounds, like white folks in the United States on race, and I see this in terms of gender around globally with men, as we realize we need to build those relationships that we were talking about earlier, how do we do it in a way that really is personally responsible for our own learning and builds, like you said, builds actual relationships and not people who are markers for our diversity learning or our gender learning or whatever particular thing we're working on. One of our challenges as we activate white folks around race and men around gender and Americans knowing their nationality and et cetera, is how to behave yourself like with the ERG members. It's like you can be an ally, but you need to be sensitive to any burden you're placing on them for your own education. And you need to make sure that the communities that ERGs represent get to be together, get to stay intact, get to support each other, and the allies don't get in the way.
Absolutely. I'll say it. You've heard me say it. I'll say it again. ERGs are not your DE&I strategy. It is not the job of Black and Brown to run and educate everyone else. Now, if you have those authentic relationships, you have psychological safety. You have a foundation to ask those questions. So to be really specific, I was sharing a recent everyday aggression on LinkedIn that I've experienced. I'll never forget coming off a stage in London for a really great presentation. You know, when you've crushed it, you've killed it.
Yeah.
The first feedback I get from a senior leader, the person says to me, "Wow, Mita, you speak English so well. Had no idea."
Wow.
Amazing. And so, you know, I had at the time my former boss, other people around there. So as you say, Chuck, in terms of allyship, no one stood up for me. No one else said anything. And that comment just sat. But somebody recently felt comfortable enough, this is where I'm encouraged, to ask me why that was upsetting. And I appreciated that because the person was not coming from a malicious place, but they're trying to learn.
I need to understand.
I think in the past, they just would have been like, I don't know what she's talking about, but that's okay. I'm not going to ask. And this time they asked, I said, you know why? It's because you're questioning my Americanness. You're questioning my right to be in the country. You're putting me in a box based on what I look. I don't need to explain it to you, but it was a great moment that this person asked me to unpack that.
And such a fantastic mismatch with the experience that you had just had in terms of killing it. I mean, it's just like, what a mess. And so many, it's like, there's so many things wrong with those six words or whatever it was that you can't even sort for all the potential responses, none of which turn out to be probably career building in the moment, but also to carry it around and to have that experience still so fresh in your own emotional memory. It's like, why do we make each other pay those prices? It's not healthy at so many levels.
And, to your point, a lot of those memories, that was not my only time where my ability to speak English well has been questioned or complimented. And I just go back to those moments, which is the work we do together, Chuck, is like, where were the allies? Where were the people who could have said something or done something as you've coached, either in the moment, but going back? The moment is still there. Even though the moment's passed, you can still go back privately.
No, because if somebody's gone to that dude and said, 10 minutes later, 2 years later, and said, you remember when you did that? Here are the 6 things that are problematic. And obviously it needs to be done in a way that wasn't a problem for you. It needed to be something that worked for you. But it's likely, when I've had those conversations and then later on, I think of a couple of clients who regularly tell the story of when Chuck talked to me about that. So they have their own emotional memory at that point.
Right.
Like, wow, I stepped in it. I didn't know intent, impact, and off. And they have this whole story, and they've made up. Actually, I think it's become more of a marker than it probably even deserves because they're carrying it around too. So the problem and the solution can have those kinds of memorable impacts on us, and that brings one of the tensions that we're always going back and forth in on the polarities is how to care for others and how to tell the truth. We're just that our agency and care for others. One of the for me the last question for our time, and we could go on for a long time.
I know we could.
we have in the past. So that's fair. You've written and led around how allies should become advocates and even activists. Why is that journey important? And what can happen when we learn to use our voice in new ways?
That's a great question. It's exactly what we just talked about.
Yeah.
In that situation, unpacking it, just to be clear for our listeners, it was a man who gave me what he thought was a compliment. And predominantly, I remember a circle of men. I think there was another woman who sort of looked at me, like she and I sort of looked at each other and that was it.
But
the question is like, there's too many of us who are bystanders watching things happen and not doing anything. So for me, the allyship journey is you're constantly learning about experiences that aren't your own and trying to gain empathy and understanding. And so we talked about how you do that learning, making sure that the burden is on you as the ally and not always burdening the communities who you want to serve, right? And you want to show up for. But the advocate piece, because for me, sometimes allies, it reminds me of what we learned in, high school history class. You're signing a secret treaty in a closed door. And so there's this passiveness. We've seen the memes around the secret allies, but the advocate piece is like, Chuck sees that happen. He's going to say something in that moment as a colleague or a leader, or if for some reason he doesn't feel comfortable, the moment's passed, he's going to go find that fellow leader and have that intervention and say, hey, here's what I saw happened. And here's what I want to talk to you about. Some cases, we have the conversation about intent versus impact, right? This was probably your intent, but here's the impact felt. And I'm sorry, there's some other situations where it's just bad behavior has to be called out. It's not intent, impact. It is not acceptable.
No, I always, previously, in a previous life, liked assume positive intent. I can't do that anymore. I don't believe in assuming positive intent. I get the idea.
Yeah.
To not assume negative intent. I think that's a good.
That's a
but
good
I'm
way.
Sorry, none of us are in our right minds all the time. I personally am not. I do not always have positive intent. That's for sure. And you can see it in my behavior, or just at least in my thoughts. I hope it doesn't always come out. So the dynamic relationship between intent and impact, impact for me as an ally and as somebody who has impacted as well, because it's a dynamic, right? Is the default part of the conversation. I think the language of ally to advocate to activist, it communicates, the language it says to me is to find your courage. And to recognize, it's been an interesting process for me, and I'd love to hear your perspective on how you've seen this. The ally work is significantly related to how I come alongside and speak up for or with others. It is also directly related, at least for those of us from multiple advantages like I am. It's very much about the work we do in our own culture with people who are like us, who are making those mistakes and or are afraid to make the mistakes, and therefore they just go silent. And they aren't present. They aren't solving. They aren't dealing with they aren't bringing a transformational lens to talent work or to the customer relationship. So to me the edge, the advocacy and activism, it's about also having the courage to do the work in your own community, in relationships with people who are in other communities.
I would agree with that. I want to leave with the positive example of how an advocate showed up for me in the workplace, because I think that's important. And this ties back to what you're talking about doing the work in your communities. Have you ever, Chuck, played the baby game? Do you know what the baby game is?
I don't.
Okay. This might sound familiar to some listeners. The baby game is a team building activity when everyone shares their baby photo. And you get to guess what baby Chuck looks like and baby Mita looks like, right? It's a very, who doesn't love babies? I'm not a baby hater.
Right. I like the name of the game as soon as you said it.
But I hate the baby game, because guess what? If you're the only person who is brown on a predominantly white team, that is not a fun game for you.
Yeah.
You can pretty easily figure out who baby Mita is. So I had this was years ago, and I had a white man colleague who understood why it was really uncomfortable for me. And he was like, hey, we can't play this game. And here's why. And he had gone and talked to, at the time, our manager. But that's a really, like, to be so empathetic, to understand that someone else's experience of, wow, this is the only brown woman on this team of like 15, mostly white women and men. Like, what an exclusionary experience that will be for her to do this game.
One of the best examples I've ever seen, I did a conference board event a number of years ago, and the platform was raised. It was when we were, again, all back in the same room, big conference, and I was moderating a panel the next day. And there was a guy from one of our clients who was at the conference, and he noticed that the chairs were really high and that they were not chairs you would want to sit on if you had a skirt on. And his boss was going to be in my panel the next day.
Wow.
So he emailed her, which is, and this is kind of like the kind of thing, like you'd have to have a relationship or just a lot of courage to do this. He emails her and says, so you need to wear slacks tomorrow, and here's why. So here's like telling his boss what she should wear to this conference. And she shows up in this awesome pantsuit. The next day it was like this red pink thing. I don't even know what color it was, but it was just like, it was awesome.
That's amazing.
And of course, like as soon as we got started, she told the story. And then it was a lesson for like, what kinds of chairs should you have on platforms at big events, you know, and who should you be thinking about when you do that? But it was like one of those moments where, and I didn't even know this was going on. I didn't know until she told the story that the guy that worked for her had emailed her. And I thought, see, this is how we have each other's back. We're taking care of each other. We care. We demonstrate it. It's practical. And it mattered to her. It so mattered to her that she told the story.
That's incredible. And so for as we sort of round out the conversation, for as many exclusionary experiences many of us have had, I'm really hopeful for people who are showing up for each other. I'm hopeful for that. I see that more and more.
Yeah. And it's good for everybody, because it like anything, it builds a relationship, it builds trust. And it invites us to keep doing it because it's fun and powerful and effective. And then we have stories to tell with each other and sometimes about each other.
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Well, thanks so much. I want us to be cognizant of our time here. Last question. Where can listeners find you online?
Please find me on LinkedIn, and please go listen to Brown Table Talk with Dee Marshall and myself. It's on Apple Podcasts. It's on Spotify. It is to help women of color win at work. But I will tell you, Chuck, I was so touched by the notes you sent after listening to the podcast. I think it's for allies as well. We need more allies to help and listen to the stories.
Yeah, because it's just, it so opens, it answers, like you said earlier, it answers any questions about the context you unpack, you know, there's like the tell the story, mutual groan, and then you explain why.
Exactly.
And the impact, and you don't stay in your lane, and you don't, clearly aren't stuck, you know, which I love. I just so appreciate it.
Not stuck anymore. not stuck
anymore. Appreciate your voice. So that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks to Meeta Malik for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion. And thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. As always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.